Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, the work is dangerous by definition, but the hazards first responders face on the job causes mental health impacts that can be just as lethal. We talk to law enforcement and firefighter professionals about what they want to see change. Later in the program, bolstering the ranks of high school referees despite problematic parents. But first, we're talking today about a difficult topic, and one we should note will involve some discussion of suicide. And if you or someone that you know needs help, you can reach out to the 24-hour crisis lifeline by dialing 988. But to talk about this issue, I'm joined here in studio by Lieutenant Cheryl Rogers, a firefighter paramedic with the Jacksonville Fire and Rescue Department and regional coordinator for Florida Firefighters Safety and Health Collaborative. Good morning, Cheryl. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Joining us by video, Chris Scallon, a retired Norfolk police sergeant and co-founder of Trauma Behind the Badge. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Very well. Thanks for being here. We're also joined here in studio by Dr. Lanty Jornby, Chief Medical Officer at Lakeview Health, an addiction treatment center here in Jacksonville. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Chris, I want to start with the work that you're doing today, but I also want to talk about the work that you've done in the past. What kind of work experience led you to be involved in trauma advocacy work for law enforcement and former law enforcement?
Great question. As a former firefighter, medic, and military veteran and police officer, I had the luxury, or not the luxury, of being exposed to all the significant traumas that are specific to those disciplines. I myself saw the adverse effects of long-term, both cumulative and acute exposure to trauma, and wound up needing help myself, and found the field of help very limited. So I took it upon myself to try to find all the resources for varying degrees of problems that I was seeing, both within myself and in my community, in the veteran or the first responder community. And since then have been involved with responses to crisis for the veterans and first responder community, from large-scale mass casualty events to personal occurrences within their own life and their family.
You received a diagnosis in your life after the work that you had done, both overseas and here in the United States with law enforcement. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, depression with suicidal ideations, and my time in the military resulted in traumatic brain injury, which adds a little flavoring and little spices to the existing diagnoses.
And your suicidal ideation was actually manifested in a few suicide attempts. Is that correct?
That's correct. While I was on the job, on the police department, it became overwhelming. And to be more specific, it was less wanting to die and more wanting that emotional pain to stop, and really not seeing a way outside of that, which now, you know, knowing hindsight 2020, that help is out there and resources are available.
I saw in an interview you talked about finding your tribe when you were able to begin talking about some of these things. And I thought it was a kind of a cute comparison to a video that was popular in the early 90s. Tell us a little bit about that metaphor.
I actually used that video of the girl with the little bee, dressed as a bee, and she was walking around and couldn't find anybody. She thought she was different and weird, and then she ran into a field of people dancing in the same kind of outfit. It's exactly it. I felt like I was the only one going through this, and nobody could understand. I was weak for it, and I was scared to ask anybody because I was normally the person that people asked for help. So it was a little intimidating, and what I tell folks now is that the day I started getting better was the day I stopped focusing on what other people thought and more how I could get better.
Cheryl Rogers, what did you know about the job of being a firefighter when you joined, and how was reality different from what you expected?
Yeah, I knew I wanted to help people, and they would pay me to help people. How awesome is that? So I was super excited about the job, and I knew how to experience some things, but no idea what exactly those experiences would look like and how exactly they would affect me over time.
Mm-hmm. And so as you began to experience the job, how did those experiences come at you? How did you deal with them, and how did they begin to accumulate and impact you?
So dealing with them, we're kind of taught in our profession, we use dark humor to laugh things off and don't really talk about feelings, and we kind of push it aside, and you know, you kind of follow suit of what everybody else is doing. So that's kind of what you're taught. It's kind of a learned behavior, and it worked until it didn't work. Cumulative, I would say, is the key. I don't recall any one particular traumatic event that I experienced affecting me, but I recall over time, you know, all of a sudden it just seemed like things were out of control.
Mm-hmm. I think you did tell me about an experience just after you had children, mm-hmm. that some of those experiences felt differently, or felt like you were having a different experience.
Sure. I've always said perspective is everything. So, you know, I didn't realize, or I should say, seeing kids in traumatic situations didn't affect me as much until I became a mother. And then when you have that, you know, mother mentality, it changes your perspective of when you see those events.
Mm-hmm. And so there was a drowning that you were called to.
Yeah. So we had a drowning, and my son at the time was the same age as this little boy. And my son had blonde hair and blue eyes, and this little boy had blonde hair and blue eyes. And working that child in the back of the rescue unit, probably the only time that I've had experienced an adrenaline dump after the call, where I just started shaking violently and became nauseated all of a sudden. And, you know, in the moment, I was just trying to do my job. But I remember thinking, wow, this kid really looks like my son. And then after the call, just kind of just fell apart and just needed a minute to recover from that. And I don't recall any other call affecting me in that way afterwards.
And was it the kind of thing that you continued to think about afterwards?
Immediately, you know, I wanted to call. It was later at night, but I made my husband at the time wake my son up, and I wanted to hear his voice. I just had to hear him and know that he was okay. And once I did that, I was okay. But yeah, I mean, you think about it from time to time, and you have those triggers, but not to the extent of that experience in that moment. But, you know, you're always going to think about the things that you've experienced.
Dr. Landy Jordanby, these challenges that people face when they work in this field, they are facing more trauma on a daily basis than most people probably do in their entire lives. And that can manifest in a bunch of different ways. What is it that you see primarily in your work, in your profession?
With veterans or first responders, we see a tremendous amount of trauma. And I think Cheryl hit on it, Chris hit on it. It's not just a one-time event, it's repeated trauma. They are exposed to multiple difficult things that they have to see, take care of, put aside their own emotion so they can handle this usually life-threatening situation. So when they come to us, they are most likely suppressing a lot of that. They haven't dealt with it. Or if they have dealt with the trauma, it's in unhealthy ways. So we know that there are a lot of veterans that, or even first responders that reach for substances because they get an immediate relief, but that becomes more of a dangerous thing. It damages their health long term, and it really prevents deeper healing from the trauma or from any co-occurring disorder that they're dealing with.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the unique mental health challenges faced by current and former first responders. And if you're a first responder yourself, or you have a story to share, you can join our conversation live on air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. Cheryl, what Dr. Jordanby was talking about in terms of substance abuse, there can be a culture of, you know, sort of celebratory, I don't know what you would call it. I mean, it's kind of, there's a little bit of a culture of the party, you know, mm-hmm. when someone is done with a shift in the world of the firefighters. And it's not universal, but it's not uncommon, right? When are you watching for when that crosses over into problem territory?
Yeah, that's tough because, you know, typically first responders are type A personalities. We work hard, we party hard. where that becomes warning signs. You know, it's often hard to see. I think when what I have learned in my own experience is when things became to the point that they took over other things in my life and made it so that I couldn't function on an everyday basis like a normal person. I didn't know what normal was. I thought what I was doing was normal, but it turns out that was nowhere near normal. I just knew it to be normal.
And is it normal because you're seeing it reflected in the behavior of those around you?
I think so. I guess because of the stigma for so long, we didn't talk about it for a while. And so I didn't really know if others were experiencing that same thing that I was experiencing on a day-to-day basis. I just kind of assumed.
Chris Gallen, talk about that, if you will, in terms of the culture of some of these agencies and how stress is commonly processed when it comes to substances.
Yeah. You know, and the lieutenant said it, but she was right on point. Our culture is we celebrate and we mourn using alcohol or substances, primarily alcohol for first responders. It's become part of the culture. And it's anything outside of the norm, because there's very few things that we can control as first responders and veterans. So the little bit of control that we have, we kind of hold on to pretty significantly. So part of that is almost a rite of passage. I mean, I was in the Navy, and the Navy's theme song has drinking in it. I mean, it's embedded into everything that we've done. And when we mourn together, the same thing. It's tough because people are different, and some people can function in that kind of atmosphere and not go to excess, where some don't. So it's exactly what the lieutenant was saying. You know, we have to kind of be aware, or at least look out for one another and say, hey, listen, this is kind of taking over your daily life, where it wasn't just a one or two time thing or every time something kind of happens, but it's becoming more habitual and it's becoming more of an issue. And we start seeing it in behavior. The problem we have is nobody wants to have that awkward talk. And first responders, we're quick to tell you what to do as a citizen, but very, very awkward for us to kind of monitor ourselves and be, hey, listen, I think you're struggling, because we perceive that as a sign of weakness when we're struggling. When in actuality, it's not. It's a sign of being human.
Whose job is that in, for instance, just in law enforcement? Is it the job of your peer, or is it the job of your superior? Who should be taking up that difficult conversation?
So it's safety. And every discipline that I've worked in, everybody has the right and the obligation to say something. And I preach that, and that's part of the culture and getting over that stigma. Is if I say something about you as a peer, as a coworker, as a supervisor, as a subordinate, it's not because I'm trying to get you in trouble. It's because I'm worried about you and I truly care about what happens to you. If I didn't care, that me not saying anything is a pretty good indicator that I just don't care. So I think it's everybody's responsibility. And sometimes it's hard when you're in the midst of this either addiction or struggle or mental health crisis to really kind of get yourself out. But the key to this is that most first responders and veterans don't want to be fixed. They just want to be given the tools to help fix themselves. And if that means providing a little help along the way for them, like, hey, I'll walk you to the doctor, or I'll walk to the meeting with the supervisor, or whatever that looks like. Sometimes that's what we need.
We have a message from John on Facebook. He says, Jacksonville-based LSF Health Systems has for years been managing a major state-funded program for first responders' mental health. Those who think they might need help should visit stayfitforduty.com. And so there are options out there. Dr. Jordan B., the numbers in terms of first responders and police and firefighters specifically who have died by suicide relative to those who have died in the line of duty really surprised me. I mean, that there is far more people dying of from suicide than from the on-the-job risks.
Yes, unfortunately, we've seen that even through COVID. I think it actually went up for most of the population, but then you add in the stresses, the unique stresses that first responders are dealing with, that veterans are dealing with, that even active duty military are dealing with, and so that just spikes it even further. And I think Chris and Cheryl have kind of hit on it, is that it's these are people that have devoted their lives to others. They are the ones that run into the burning building. And when it comes to taking care of themselves and asking for help, it comes with some shame, some belief that they are just not strong enough, because the culture is definitely in the military and veterans, as well as first responders, is that they're superheroes. They are the ones that tell other people what to do and take care of everyone. And being able to ask for help and get into treatment, whatever that looks like, is a very hard thing to do. So I feel like, you know, Cheryl and I were talking earlier, peer support is so key to getting, you know, that one moment where they say, okay, I've got to get help. Talking to a peer and then getting that peer to direct them to the right place is key.
Chris, one of the challenges you talked about was just, you know, the culture, but there are real practical challenges for a law enforcement officer, say, who's facing, or someone who's in the military, is facing a mental health crisis because they are entrusted with carrying weapons and they don't want to be seen as unstable for that reason. It can actually have really profound impacts on their job. So how do you help someone who's concerned about that particularly balance that if they want help, but they don't want to put their careers at risk or make people think that they're not stable because of the work that they're doing?
No, it's a great question. And quite honestly, it's the one I get all the time. And there's two aspects of it. The first one is, it's a job, and I would much rather you be healthy than try to exist in an unhealthy environment. I'm not saying unsafe, because a lot of the stuff we do is there's an inherent danger to it. But when it comes to getting help or not getting help because of the job, I try to have them focus on the long run. Some people don't need to be doing this. And at certain points in time, you know, if mental health creeps up or substance issues creep up, they don't need to be doing that job right now. Some people can return. That's a possibility. And more people need to understand that getting help does not automatically equate to losing your job or losing your security clearance. There's a pause. It's the same thing as if I broke my leg. Could I be doing the same job? No. I've got to fix my leg. I've got to let that heal. It's no different when we're dealing with mental health or substance issues. So it's getting the idea, which is part of the stigma, that if I get help, I won't be able to work or I won't be able to do this. I can't say that blanketly because some people have issues that far surpass their ability to work. So it's a case by case, but predominantly people getting help actually return to the workforce and become unbelievable advocates for healthiness and a healthy living while doing this very inherently dangerous and taxing job. So it's a benefit to support the folks that are asking for help and willing to get it and going through the work and then coming back and have them as champions to make your agency better by having a healthier person working at it.
Cheryl, I want to ask you about just the demands of the job and particularly something about scheduling, because we know that there's a lot of things that go into people experiencing stress, and clearly seeing traumatic events, seeing injured children or kids who've been abused or whatever that particular traumatic trigger is for someone is only exacerbated by things like if you're not sleeping. So tell us a little bit about the schedule that, for instance, firefighters are on and how that can contribute to experiences of stress.
Yeah, I've been kind of banging the drum of circadian rhythm and all the links that it has to all the problems or a lot of the problems in our professions for a while now.
And explain what circadian rhythm
so
is for people.
Circadian rhythm is your body's on-off cycle. So we're designed to shut down at night and sleep. And during that sleep process, our cells regenerate, our body heals itself, our mind actually processes and files all the things we experience that day. You know, it holds them, I call them, in like an upload file, and then it downloads them to where they're supposed to go and files them appropriately during that time. Unfortunately, as first responders or anybody really in a shift work type base environment, you don't get that time to shut down and process. We work typically as firefighters 24-hour shifts. Our typical schedule is 24 on, 48 off. So in that 24-hour period, you have a bed you can try to sleep in, but you're going to get woken up throughout the night regardless of, you know, where you are. Most of the time you're going to get up and go on calls. That's just the nature of the job. We sleep when we can, we eat when we can, but, you know, when the buzzer goes off, we get up and we go. So we don't typically have that time to shut down and process all this, all that we're supposed to do and the way our body's supposed to heal during that shift work. And then when we go home, we have to get off that morning and go function as a normal human being. So, you know, we're sleep deprived and we have to pick up our kids from school and we have to take them to practice and we have to do all the things, you know, that our family expects of us, and with a smile on our face and not be grumpy about it, you know. And then we get that night to kind of rest and process. And then the next night when we're going to go back to work the next morning, your mind's already in that mindset of, okay, tomorrow I'm going to work. I don't want to oversleep. I want to make sure, you know, nothing happens. How am I going to keep my crew and everybody safe tomorrow? So you really have one night and that's it. And your body doesn't get that time to shut down and process and regenerate the way it's supposed to. And then you add to that, I think, overtime stresses of the job. I think firefighters, I joke, you can go into any fire station in any city and probably see a CPAP machine in the bunk room, because our sleep cycles are so messed up. It doesn't matter if we're healthy, because we tend to be typically healthier, you know, as a population in the fire service. But you can walk in any bunk room and probably see a CPAP machine, because we don't sleep well even when we do try to sleep, because our body's now just used to not sleeping well. And it affects so many things. It affects disease. You know, I think it contributes to the cancer that's in the fire service. I think it contributes to the mental health problems that are in the fire service. I think it contributes to so many things. And a lot of departments, I think, are starting to recognize that and looking at the research and starting to change some of the way our shift schedules are.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because firefighters, for instance, here, when you talk about a 24-hour cycle, that's an 8 a.m. to 8 a.m.?
Correct.
So you go to work at 8 a.m. and then you get off at 8 in the morning, and Right. You basically are then embarking on a full day. Mm-hmm. But not everybody does it that way.
No, not everybody. So I know, for instance, Tallahassee, I know for years, has worked on a 7 p.m. to 7 p.m. schedule. So they relieve at 7 o'clock at night. And
that gives them an opportunity to kind of go home and go
right.
to bed.
That's the nice thing about that. You can go home and sleep in your own bed and recover. So you're getting the same number of calls in that 24-hour shift as you do, you know, on our shift. But then you get to go home and lay in your own bed and kind of regenerate and process and recover. Some departments are going to 24/72s instead of 24/48, so you have one extra day off in between. Some departments are looking at the sleep environment in the stations and giving people more individual, because we kind of sleep in a gen pop type environment where there's just one room with a bunch of bunks in it. So kind of segregating off each room. And then when the tones go off, if you have a multi-company station where there's like an engine and a rescue and a ladder, if the engine goes on a call, the ladder and the rescue's sleeping area don't activate, you know, for them to wake up. So their sleep isn't interrupted needlessly when they're not even supposed to go on the call. So there's a lot of things that I think from a health and safety standpoint, fire departments are looking at, and that's a good thing. But I think we still have a really long way to go, unfortunately.
Dr. Jornby, how important is the structural elements, things like sleep, when it comes to correcting for some of the workplace traumas that first responders experience? Are there other things that are structural that could help reshape how damaging some of those experiences can be?
Well, I think Cheryl did a great job of explaining what happens when you sleep. Your body does just heal, regenerate, recover. The whole part that she explained about processing all the information that you took in during the day, your experiences, traumatic events that you responded to, life-threatening events that you saw, all of that stuff gets processed in the brain in certain areas. And if you don't get that time to do that, it still kind of sits in kind of the more recent parts of the brain. And then it can become, not for everybody, but it can become something that you can't let go. And then we kind of think about repeated traumas on top of that. You layer more and more exposure to events and traumatic things, and you never get to process it in a deeper part of the brain. And so then it's so recent, it's so accessible, that it can create problems with you know, just day-to-day function, making sure that you get sleep when you're not working, when your sleep it becomes disrupted with nightmares or other events like that. So I think some of the things she mentioned are really great, and I hadn't heard about them. Changing the structure, changing the time frame of their shifts, making sure that certain environments aren't exposed to other parts of the station, so people can get into some sort of deeper sleep, because those deeper sleep, the REM sleeps, are really where you're going to have more healing. So I think what they're doing is great.
Do we know if there are there certain kinds of traumas that hit people harder than others, or does it really just depend on the individual?
I think it's individual by individual, although, you know, Cheryl shared something about taking care of a child that had been a victim of a drowning. I mean, that was a very individual thing for her, but I think we are all somewhat sensitized to a child and a helpless individual that's in a life-threatening event. And so that's always going to really affect us in many ways. But I have seen veterans who were really affected by certain things they saw on the battlefield, or even veterans who were pilots who end up taking out targets and things like that, that they were really affected because of certain experiences that they had gone through. So it really is, I would say, individualized.
Chris, I know that there's some states that have been expanding their definition of who can file a claim for a traumatic experience at work. And I mean, it's sort of not everybody knows, but I mean, there's if there was a workplace shooting, for instance, where I work, you know, I would probably be eligible to file for, you know, a claim of some injury. Law enforcement, first responders very often aren't able to, because it's sort of expected, right? That's the job. But that's changing. I think there are more places that recognize PTSD or a traumatic experience as something that is an actual legitimate claim.
Yeah, and the doc would probably speak to this a little bit more better as far as the measurable injury. But trauma is a measurable injury to the brain. And there are states, again, this is slow moving. And when Lieutenant was talking about, you know, the changes, and sometimes maybe they're not as quick enough, and I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, we're moving, and maybe not as fast as I want to, for the sake of other first responders and veterans. But we are moving. The environment that we're seeing, the landscape that we see now for the willingness to kind of address these issues, is a lot better than it was when myself, or I'm sure the lieutenant, first started, where this would, having a conversation in private, let alone on air, would never have happened. But yeah, so each states are different. And again, I'd like to see maybe a federal collaborative effort to kind of maybe have a blanket type of understanding. But listen, until then, there are resources that are available. And I encourage, no matter what state you're in, and I've had I've been fortunate to travel kind of around the country with this. It's funny that all the states are different, but we're all working on the same kind of issue. But I would say be a champion for the cause. Be a student of your craft. If you're struggling, or you work with folks that are struggling, see what's regionally available, what's nationally available. They're out there, and some of the leaders and policies of all disciplines are actually working on this. And to me, it's encouraging. Again, I wish it was a little bit faster, but there are things there. So, and any questions, look to your state and look to your local, regional, and national resources.
Cheryl, first of all, I'd like you to characterize how receptive firefighters, for instance, are to change.
There's a standing joke in the fire service. Two things firefighters hate the most: change and the way things are. And I always say it would be funny if it weren't so true. We're not typically receptive to change. We like our traditions. We like our culture. And when typically people come in using the word change, we tend to shut down almost immediately. I think it's moving, like he said. I think, you know, the stigma's starting to go away and people are talking, but it's always in small doses, especially in our line of work. It's, you know, you have to baby step them through it.
One of the things that you have worked on is the issue of the hazards of certain things that are beyond trauma and beyond just the workplace dangers, but things like uniforms, which have for a long time been a carcinogenic risk to firefighters because of the flame retardant that they contain. A lot of firefighters got sick, and that's a whole different area, but one that has been very difficult to change.
Yes, and you know, I kind of wanted to touch on that when Chris mentioned earlier, you know, it is such a, you know, suicide is such an up and coming cause of death in firefighters, but cancer is right now the leading cause of death. And we were all taught in when we came on that heart disease was the leading cause. And heart disease, I think if suicide were recognized as a line of duty death, heart disease would be a dismal third, because I think it would be cancer and then suicide. And it's unfortunate that it's not recognized as it should be. But there's so many things in this job that are harmful to us. The things we're exposed to, not just visually, but, you know, chemically, all the exposures that we have in the fire station, our gear, our station uniforms, the diesel exhaust on the apparatus that we ride on. There's a million things, you know, that cause cancer, and we know that within the general population. But when you look at firefighters and the things we're exposed to daily, you know, you kind of see every third day that chronic low dose exposure that we're getting on a constant basis for 20 or 30 years. And then that's why we're seeing these high incidences of cancer. And I think mental health issues as well.
We did get a message on Facebook from somebody who's raising an interesting point about racial disparities in terms of the care that firefighters or first responders have received historically in the realm of mental health. What are your thoughts about that disparity and whether that's getting any better, Dr. Jordan B?
I think that's very interesting, because through COVID, we actually saw a disparity for people of color as far as substance use. So traditionally, the numbers show that Black people or Hispanic people were not as susceptible to overdose rates or overdose deaths. But through COVID, we actually saw the numbers of people of color actually go up as far as overdose deaths. So we're now recognizing that that is not an exclusive issue for a Caucasian person. And in fact, people of color really do suffer from higher rates of substance use. And I think that goes hand in hand with mental health too. So I would agree that there has been a disparity as far as recognizing that someone of color is dealing with a mental health issue, whether it be PTSD. We saw it in the VA system when I worked there. And I think that the more recognition we give it, we can certainly make more efforts to reach out to those populations and get people into treatment, because PTSD and substance use and mental health disorders don't discriminate. They affect everybody and in really definite, severe ways.
Chris, I saw a panel discussion that you did sometime back where you were talking about being able to look for the right thing. And you were talking about being trained by another officer when you were finding a gun or looking for a gun, and he kind of redirected you. Can you explain why that metaphor was helpful in terms of the issue of substance abuse and suicide risk?
Yeah, so basically it's you're trying to find a needle in a stack of needles, a very specific needle. And I had a field training officer, actually one of the guys that I worked with, and he was, he said, Chris, if you want to find a gun on somebody and you're looking, and I train you how to find a gun on somebody, you'll find 90% of the guns. But if I train you how to find a razor blade, you'll find 100% of the guns. So the razor blade to me was these subtle shifts in personality, the subtle changes in relationship dynamics, and focusing on individuals and how they respond in certain situations. So instead of just every time I see you at a party, you're drinking or you're using, how about, do I know your baseline, or am I only seeing you at a party? So the idea of looking for the razor blade to find all the guns is looking for those little subtle cues that are, in all actuality, aren't very subtle once you start understanding what to look for. So that helped me. It actually helped me identify what I was struggling with substance issues. But once I figured that out, it made it a little bit easier to kind of identify folks that are struggling.
Well, I want to thank you all for being here for this important discussion. Cheryl Rogers, Chris Scallon, Dr. Lanty Jordan B. Thanks all of you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much for having.
And of course, if you or someone that you know needs help, you can call the 24-hour crisis hotline at 988. Up next, a nationwide shortage of youth football referees hits home.
river is high.
Welcome back. It's a job that demands physical fitness, an ability to make snap decisions, and occasionally to hear crowds of people chanting that they want to kill you. To talk about the joys and challenges of working as a referee, I'm joined now by Zachary Roth of the North Florida Officials Association. Hey, Zach, welcome
back.
Good
morning. Thank you.
And Sam Maroon, president of North Florida Officials Association. Welcome.
Good morning, Ann.
Good to have you. So you are both attorneys in Jacksonville. I guess reffing is just stress relief for that kind of level of work.
Yeah. Officiating actually kind of transfers well because there's a lot of rules study and stuff. So it's similar to learning laws and that kind of stuff. And, you know, being a lawyer, a lot of times people are mad at you. So, it, you know, kind of gets you accustomed to being an official as well.
What brought you, Sam, to officiating? Were you a player as yourself?
A long, long time ago. Yeah. And I was. And then I have a now 24-year-old son. So I started off coaching him through youth football. And then when he got to middle school and high school, I was very gently told I didn't need to coach him anymore, that they had some professional coaches there, that they were, you know, fully staffed and they didn't need me anymore. And so I was kind of left with, what do I do? It's the fall. I'm used to being out there running around a little bit and enjoying the sport of football. And how do I stay involved other than just sitting in the stands and watching my son play? So I got into the refereeing business.
And Zach, you do some college level officiating as well?
Yeah, I do. I work in the FCS level, so lower level Division I. That's basically exclusively what I do in the fall now because the schedule conflicts with high school. But I started here working with Sam and with the NFOA in games and then have transitioned over to college.
Did you also play?
I did. I joked that I practiced college football. I didn't play it that much. But so I did that at Division III school. And then kind of similar to Sam, I got out and I said, I need to be involved in the game somehow. And officiating is good because you can control your schedule. If you're too busy with work or family obligations, you can not work games and that's okay. You're not going to get fired. You know, if you're a coach, you can't not show up that week. Mm-hmm. So it gives some flexibility.
So we kind of alluded to some of the challenges of being a referee. They're not small. I mean, anybody that's been to a youth soccer game knows that parents can be out for blood. Football, probably not real different.
No, it's not. I enjoy it. So maybe it's a this little sick pleasure I get out of it, but I actually like the being yelled at. It's fun to me. But yeah, you can't take yourself too seriously is a big thing with that. The officials, I think, that get themselves in trouble that you see are the ones that take themselves too seriously. But there is a lot of yelling. It can be long hours to work games. You know, you show up early. If you're working a varsity game on Friday night, you show up at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, depending on the game. You don't get home till midnight and you make $100 doing it. So if you're in it for the money, it's probably not going to be happy about how it goes. But if you love the game and you love giving back to our local youth, it's a fantastic thing to do.
How about you, Sam? How do you deal with those pressures, and what about it continues to be appealing enough to you to override that?
Well, part of it, Ann, I think is the relationships that I've been able to develop with my fellow officials. Zach and I, a good example of that, have become pretty good friends. Not sure as attorneys we would have ever become friends just because we're kind of on the opposite sides of a lot of different types of cases. But through officiating, I've really become good friends with a lot of people that I probably would not have ever come in contact with. And Zach mentioned, you know, on a Friday night, it can be long hours, but what I cherish is that last hour or two where after the game and we've showered and we've gone out and we're having a hamburger and a beverage and we're talking about, you know, not only how that game went, but what's going on with our lives. And you really get to really become close friends with a lot of these folks that you work with on Friday nights. And it's a special part of the job.
Do you think that being a ref has made you a better lawyer? Or the reverse?
Definitely the reverse.
Yeah.
Like I am a better official because of what I do for a living during the day. I think maybe I'm better at what I do during the day because of the break I get. The skills are similar, but everything else is so different that when I go to work a football game on Friday night or Saturday, it's entirely different. So by the time I come back Monday, I'm a little bit more refreshed from, I'm not thinking about work over the weekend because I'm 100% focused on that game that I'm working.
So there is a shortage right now of refs for, I guess, middle school and high school level football. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
And so what are you doing to recruit new refs, and what opportunities are there for people to get involved?
So we have a training every summer for new officials that are interested, and it doesn't cost anything to show up. And if you want to, you know, give it a shot, and you could see if you like it. We don't hold grudges if people come and they decide they don't like it. But something that we're excited about this year that we're doing in partnership with the Jaguars and local law firm Driver McAfee is we're being sponsored to use the flex field for our trainings with the new officials this year at the stadium.
That's the right adjacent to, for people who don't know, that's the Miller facility? Yeah, or the
next to Daly's place. So the original facility, not the Jaguars practice facility. But it's great because a lot of times bowls and in the past, Riverside High School had been gracious enough to allow us to use their facilities. But being outside in the summer, the weather's unpredictable. So a lot of times we'd get together and we wouldn't really be able to do a great job of training because we'd have a thunderstorm or something. Now we don't have to worry about that. We have this ability to use this conditioned facility and really try to provide a great opportunity for people that are interested to see what it's like and learn from experienced officials.
And Sam, what do you say to people in terms of if they're on the fence or even, you know, vaguely considering it? What, how do you tell them? Do you encourage people to try?
Absolutely. 100%. And, we take people that have been involved with the game, and then we take people that have never been involved with the game of football at all. Mm-hmm. And we will train you. We will teach you how to be a great official. And, it's just an exciting way to, you know, everyone talks about Friday Night Lights and the mystique of Friday Night Lights. We're out there every Friday night under the lights, you know, running around, enjoying it and really giving back to you know, the local youth and the football, the game of football.
And what counties do you serve?
Duval, St. John's, Clay, Nassau, and Baker.
And so if someone wants to get involved, are they allowed to just be like, I want to stay in my county?
So for the middle school and junior varsity games, we try to give assignments close to either where you work or where you live. That way people aren't traveling long distances on Tuesday nights or Wednesday nights. Varsity games, it's a little bit more flexible that you probably need to be able to work in our full area. I'll let Sam correct me if I'm wrong on that.
No, that's true, Zach. You know, the Friday night varsity football games, you can expect to be scheduled. You know, one week you're at Baker County, the next week you're at Ponte Vedra, the next week you may be at Ed White. So you will get to see a lot of the different schools, which I think is part of the allure. You know, I've been to virtually every high school in our area. It's funny when I meet new clients, and you know, often they have children in high school, and I was, where do kids go to high school? And I explain to them, I was like, well, I'm a high school official, so I was at your son's school last year for this game or that game, and it's a way to start conversation.
Just briefly, where can they get information?
They can go to nfoa.org. That's our organization's website, and that has all the contact info.
All right. Zachary Roth, Sam Maroon, thank you so much for being here and telling us all about it.
Thank you for having
Thanks,
us.
Man.
All right. Coming up, art steeped in the history of the Moncrief community.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. When people are hurt through no fault of their own, answering who, what, when, where, why, and how is critical to proving the truth. More at terrellhogan.com.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
Etsy used to be the place to shop for unique handmade items from makers all over the world. But now small businesses are being pushed out in favor of listings for mass-produced products.
There was a tag on it and a barcode, and it was clearly not the handcrafted item that I had paid for.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Griffin Dunn grew up in Beverly Hills, where his family would host Hollywood celebrities. That made for entertaining stories, but at the heart of his new memoir, Griffin writes about how the Dunn family overcame significant traumas, including the murder of his sister, Dominique. His book is called The Friday Afternoon Club. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
We all hear things differently. That can be tough when there's so much noise. But how do we better listen to each other? I'm Jen White, host of 1A. This election year, we're a space to speak up. We're also committed to the idea of becoming better listeners. That's what 1A is all about, from WAMU and NPR.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The community of Moncrief is rich with history and with surprises. It's home to a natural spring and, legend says, home of the original curly fry, which I did not know. But it's a story that's often overshadowed by poverty and violence, and a local artist is working to counter that narrative. I'm joined now by Alyssa Adams. She's the UNF student artist in residence at the Museum of Contemporary Art Jacksonville and the creator of the Voices of Moncrief exhibit. Welcome, Alyssa.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Thanks for being here. We're also joined by Ylva Rouse, Senior Curator at MoCA. Thanks so much for being here.
Our pleasure.
So, Alyssa, you were born in Jacksonville. When did you first become interested in the history of Moncrief?
Well, recently I just became interested in the history. I was born and raised in Moncrief and lived there my entire life. So it was just recently when I had to write a proposal for this show before I became the artist in residence to submit it. And that's when I started doing some research about Moncrief, because like you said, I wanted to counter the narrative that people have created of Moncrief, that it's like poor and violent, that's not what I've seen growing up.
So the way that you've laid out your exhibit, and we'll get into more of kind of the work that you do. It's really varied and really expressive and beautiful. But the way that you've laid out the exhibit actually begins with a video monitor that sort of has a story about a crime that's happened in the Moncrief area. Why did you choose to begin with that visual?
Because some people don't know the narrative of Moncrief. So I wanted to kind of introduce them to what outside people think, and then slowly like bring them into this beautiful display of like the history of Moncrief, like C.L. Lewis, Eartha White, Eugene Moncrief, who Moncrief is named after, and then like the current residents that are there now that have like renovated Eartha's farm, and Seifu, who's like a huge community leader there, and he helps a lot of students there. So
Ylva, what is being an artist in residence? What does it entail? How is a student selected?
Well, it's a very competitive opportunity that we offer UNF seniors. And we have a committee, and they go through a long process. And we were very happy this year to get Alyssa.
And what is the... is it more of a benefit for the student or the art institution, this relationship?
Absolutely for the student. It's one of the many career opportunities that we offer to UNF students. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a rare opportunity to be able to work so closely with all the departments, not only the curatorial department, but to learn how to interact with the museum institution, things like that.
And it's a unique opportunity, Alyssa, to have a full-scale exhibition like this, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So you do a variety of different kinds of work, including woodcut, which your pieces are just really unbelievably expressive. I don't know how hard it is, and perhaps you could tell us, just to create images in wood that have that much emotion and passion.
I don't know. It's come very easy to me now, but it was very hard at first. So I just started studying artists like Latoya Hobbs, Swoon, Irving Herrera. They're like very, very known woodcut artists. And I just started studying their expression and like kind of adding it into my work. So it took some time, like probably like 2 years for me to get that expressive.
also in the way that this exhibit is created, there's handprints throughout, almost like children's handprints.
Yes.
Whose idea was that, and whose handprints are they?
It's some people in Moncrief. Also, some of the people that actually work at MoCA, because some of them are from Moncrief as well. So some of them are Seifu students, family members who also live in Moncrief. It was my idea. I really just wanted to involve them more in the show. So that's why I had them come put their handprints on their wall, kind of to leave their mark on MoCA, mm-hmm. you know, because even though they paint over it, their handprint is still there.
There's a piece that I at least those who are watching our live stream will be able to see, and we'll post it on social media afterwards. But it's a large piece that you've done. It's called Burned Roots that you did last year. It's a house at the center of what is really kind of a troubled background. You use ashes to make it and sheet metal. And it's kind of sinister, and it's also kind of beautiful. What was the inspiration for that piece in particular?
Well, growing up, I had a lot of friends whose fathers were incarcerated, and also they just didn't have a father in the home. So I kind of wanted to display that stigma that's within the Black community, to challenge it as well, because it's just a generational curse that I wish would end, because I know that the people that I'm around, they really did desire their father to be there. So I just want to show how society affects the Black home, as well as like inside issues affect it as well. So the back wall is like society, I guess you could say, and how it burns and it comes into the home and burns it from the inside out.
So this is an exhibit that's going to be up until when?
September 8th.
September 8th, okay. And mm-hmm. there are some free admission days at MoCA?
Every Saturday and many other days.
All right. Well, Alyssa Ilova, thank you so much for being here. Great exhibit. Really nice to talk to you
about
it.
Thank you. It's nice meeting you.
And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions, and you can send either to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Join us tomorrow when we talk about why living in a violent neighborhood can lead to chronic insomnia. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.